Welcome to Tuke Talk, a video podcast by the band Tuke, and brought to you by Black Frog Media. We chat with the best in the music industry from yesterday and today, with a focus on the good old days of Canadian rock. This episode originally streamed live on Tuesday, April 27, 2021 on Facebook Live. Now, here are your hosts, Todd, Brent, Shane, Corey, and Darren.
Yeah.
You know what that means? It means it's 6:30 in Newfoundland right now.
That's right.
They don't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that. The math is always confusing when it comes to Newfoundland.
Yes, exactly.
Has anybody here been
an hour off?
Fitz and I have been to Newfoundland. You must have been to Newfoundland, right, Corey?
That's the only province I've never been to.
Shania's never been to Newfoundland?
Nope.
We haven't done Newfoundland with Slash, though, have we?
I think we did.
But
we played with the Trues and Aerosmith. And
I thought that was in Nova Scotia, wasn't it?
Somebody online is going to know. They're going to.
I played a thing in St. John's, Newfoundland, like a festival type thing in static and stereo, like a hundred. Well, 20 years ago now.
Yeah, you did. I'm pretty sure you did, because my buddy Sean lives out in Newfoundland, and I think he went to that show. Yeah, so I'm pretty sure you did.
Yeah, you're probably right. It's all a bit of a blur.
Obviously, that memorable. You know.
Well, I will say the people out there are awesome. They like to throw. Well, I mean, I think because so rarely do they get shows that come from other places out there that they sort of take full advantage.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic place. I've never been, but I want to, because it's one of those things that, well, especially coming from the prairies, going anywhere.
They will drink you under the table, sir.
Well, you know, I'll take my chances. I've been practicing my whole life, so.
I got to quickly point out Darren's shirt. Brent hasn't taken note of it yet. I'm waiting for him to catch on. It's a Sammy Kerr shirt from the film Trick or Treat. It's a scary, an 80s horror movie that was heavy metal. I guess remember that in the 80s, there was a whole thing about heavy metal being related to the devil and all this nonsense.
And let's not dance around the star of the show, Skippy from Family Ties, who played Ragman.
And that's actually his real name, is Skippy from Family Ties.
Mark something. What was his last name? Mark something.
I can't remember. I do remember him doing
Mark Price. That's it.
Yeah. Mark Price. Wow. There you go. Wow. I wonder where that guy is. Ozzy Osbourne.
Trick or Treat too.
Yeah. Exactly. He's been floating that script around for like 30 years, but. Ozzy Osbourne played a priest in it, and Gene Simmons played a radio DJ, like a heavy metal DJ. Yeah.
Nuke. Yeah.
It was fun. In fact, I might try and convince my wife to sit down and watch that. Oh, here's something that was out when you were an infant.
I make my wife watch it once a week, so she falls asleep all the time, but I still put it on.
Yeah. You just got to turn it up louder. That's all.
Exactly. So how's everybody doing? We're no Shane today. Shane is preoccupied, so he's
away.
He's away. Yeah,
in another.
He seems to be away a lot. That guy. He's always he's jet setting these days. Good for him.
He is.
Yeah.
He is.
And on that note, how's everything down for you guys? We're going back into restrictions as of 12 o'clock tonight.
Rainbows here. Wow.
Yeah,
it's all rainbows. In fact, Biden just announced the releasing of the mask wearing outdoors if you're vaccinated.
Yeah, that's awesome. So
if you're vaccinated, you have to, or you don't have to?
You don't have to wear a mask outside if you're vaccinated.
Now, is that mandatory if you're not right now?
Well, it is, but I mean, there's no way they can really police it.
Yeah.
But it's expected, I suppose.
Okay, yeah, because I don't think it's actually like mandatory here, but it's encouraged to do so. But yeah, so here's the new rules that they put in place here. This is the best. As of tomorrow, I can't have any single person I know on my patio, but I can go to a restaurant and sit on a patio with three strangers. Explain that. I don't know, but I guess they're trying, you know, maybe to boost business. I don't know, but.
But that's the hard part right now, is it's like, you know, you have to do what you can to keep these businesses open. It's going to be rough trying to bounce back from all this. So,
yeah, exactly. Well, as a business owner, I'm just going to license my patio and then I'll stay.
There you go.
So, yeah.
There you go.
Brent, you're doing something exciting today. Where are you? Or is that something you can talk about?
I'm doing nothing. I've just been very bad. I've been banished to this corner, dark room in this scary house. No. Well, I am in
there. What'd you do now? I know, right?
So I'm just doing a little recording here. And so I just snuck away
somewhere.
Just to back up a couple days too, I actually got to play a little bit in.
Oh, that's right. I want
to
talk about
that. We were going to go to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm doing a little playing today. And I was doing a little playing on the weekend. So I'm pretty fired up. I played an outdoor gig in Phoenix with Alice Cooper and friends. It was
never heard of him.
a golf tournament. So everything was outside. The stage was outside. The people were outside and, you know, fairly distanced in everyone, you know, but in generally speaking, there wasn't a mandatory mask situation. And, I don't want to comment other than it was really great to play with some people and play some music outside with, you know, the chance to, instead of just, you know, playing to a screen or something. Yeah. We actually had an audience. So
who was all there? It was Tommy Thayer from Kiss, Lou Gramm from Foreigner. And I saw Damon Johnson, ex Alice Cooper, brother Kane, bunch of the Alice Cooper guys, Chuck Garrick. Who else was there?
Yep. Our buddy Frank Sidoris from Slash.
Frank Sidoris, of course. The head conspirator.
Yeah, and you know, Alice's son Dashiell is a singer. So his band played and a whole bunch of great, Alice and his wife Cheryl have a really great, and it's been going for many years now, Alice Cooper's Solid Rock Foundation, which really is about, you know, supporting teenagers and giving them a place to go and be creative, dance, music, art. And so it's, you know, it's all through that organization that they raise a lot of money and then, you know, have a golf tournament. So, which is also a good thing to do outside, which
you get out and golf? So
I didn't. I was gonna. I came out here on
Brent. We had a golf phase there for a while. Didn't you get into golf for a minute there?
You know, I liked it because it was outdoors and, you know, get a little exercise and fresh air. And then I realized it's really hard. It's a terrible sport because it really can get you.
Yeah.
You're getting it makes good, people and then
crazy,
you're just like,
dude. It's so funny how it makes people crazy because they're like, you can never be good enough. Or it's always, I guess it's part of the fun of like, well, I'll do better tomorrow. You can wake up and go do it again kind of thing. Yeah. But I've known people who drives them crazy.
I'm really great at sinking my club into the grass.
No, I think I'm surprised, Corey, because I do play hockey with you and you're a great hockey player. And I think the hockey leads to the golf. Like there's a little bit of, you know, you got to have some skills.
It depends how you do in the playoffs. Well, am I right?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the strange thing, though. I actually golf opposite of what I shoot in hockey.
Oh, interesting. Are you left-handed hockey?
I shoot left, but I golf right.
As do I. I'm right both ways.
Darren, what'd you say?
I think I'm with you on that.
I'm the same. Yeah. I shoot left hockey, golf, and right-handed golf too.
Okay,
I'm right-handed. Normal, I'm right-handed both ways. That's interesting.
You're right all the time, Todd.
except I'm terrible at both sports. So there's that.
So how many people were invited to be part of that, Brent? Like, was it a socially distanced thing? I saw some of the photos, but I mean, it looked like they were kind of, you know, is it?
Yeah.
What was the live scene like?
All the people out front were in tables, but spread out. And then they had a whole crowd of people at the back. But I have to say it was very inspiring because it was well done. And I'm confident that the people that were there were respectful of, you know, space and everything. But there was a way to have a great outdoor thing, you know, musically and charity and whatnot. You know, people should take note that we could probably do some more of those pretty soon.
Alice is such a huge part of the Phoenix community that way. You know, he's always doing something. Like at Christmas time, he does something, and in the summertime, he does something, usually, if he's around, to do charity work and benefit stuff.
And I'm sure it's common knowledge, too. We talk about golf, but he's an amazing golfer now, too.
Yeah.
I mean, just unbelievable.
Scratch golfer. He's incredible. Now, one of the things he did mention to me that is great to talk on Took Talk is that the golf course that we were on, which is Las Sendas in Mesa, just, you know, one of the suburbs of Phoenix, owned by Canadians. All of the houses surrounding the golf course, all Canadians.
All from Winnipeg.
Everybody from Winnipeg, right?
Yeah, probably.
Amazing.
Well, I was staying with my friend Peter from Winnipeg that lives in Phoenix. So yeah, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of Canadians and Winnipeggers, a lot of Albertans I met.
Is that Peter, our mutual friend?
Yeah. What's interesting though, is, you know, one of the most common conversations was the quarantine, the border crossing, and, you know, everybody's got a story about, well, I just never, you know, if you were stuck down in the States, you just never went back home. Or, you know, they were asking me how, cause I went last year to, back, as you know, Darren, up to Winnipeg and
a couple times
my parents.
Yeah.
So that's basically the topic of conversation, is always, you know, crossing borders and how to, you know, quarantine safely and that. So, yeah. And it's not getting easier, because now there's that mandatory 3-day government approved. What is it? Hotel?
Yeah. My daughter had to do that. It's brutal.
Really?
Yeah. You can't really pick the hotel. They go, you're staying here and you got to pay for it yourself, kind of thing. It's brutal.
Right.
But there's light at the end of the tunnel. We're heading into the other side of it now, so that's good.
And on that note, I mean, lots to talk about, but obviously our guest this week has more than lots to talk about, because he's been involved with more things than any of us could probably count. So I think it's probably best that we bring him on, because, I mean, we probably got a load of stories in tow here. So Corey, we'll put it to you to do the intro today.
All right, we got a really big shoe for sure.
A really big shoe.
So our guest today, I met on my first Shania tour. He was brought in to mix the show by Mutt Lang himself, and stayed for decades. We've been friends that long. He's from Manchester, England. And he started working at the ripe old age of 17 back in 75. So you do the math.
Wow.
He's really old now.
Baby, don't talk like that.
he started as a tape op, and he worked his way up the ranks to assistant engineer, mix engineer, producer, and has had an amazing career working with people like Def Leppard, of course. We're going to talk all about that today. He was around there for Pyromania and Hysteria, and after, even. So that's pretty cool. He worked with Brian Adams and Waking Up the Neighbors, recorded all of that. He worked way back with The Cult back in the day. He's mixed stuff for Britney Spears, The Corrs, Iron Maiden, 4 albums with Iron Maiden, The Scorpions, AC/DC, Extreme, Ronnie James Dio.
The Cars? Was that
the
in there?
Cars, the Cars, yep. The yep. Outfield, cool. A Flock of Seagulls, Billy Ocean, the Backstreet Boys, Katrina and the Waves, and tons more. So, without
it'd be hilarious ado, after all this if he wasn't there when we were.
He's like, that intro was way too long.
Yeah, he's just like, hello.
Yeah. Well, he's probably so old, he's probably gone to the bathroom like 3 or 4 times within that intro. No, I'm just giving him a hard time. I always do. He's one of the most humble people you'll ever meet. And he's one of my very best friends. Please welcome to Tuk Talk, Mr. Nigel Green.
Yeah. Nigel, first question. Nigel, first question. Man City or Man United?
Man United.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. You know, it's so...
Like 3 miles away from the field, so it wasn't that far.
There you go. I actually never really knew the difference as a kid. I just knew, and I remember like
playing. But Man City was shit, and Man United was great.
Well, that's the difference. That's the difference. There it is.
So this is a football thing, I'm assuming.
Soccer, yeah. Football.
Soccer here. Yeah.
I was playing a gig, and there's some guys in the audience getting rowdy, and they're from Manchester. We started going, Man United, Man United. And they were like, no. They got really angry at us. And I was like, whoa, what? Turned out they were Man City. I learned that lesson very, very loudly. So now tribal. I ask that every time. It's super tribal. Oasis guys are like Man City, and they don't even want to talk about anything else.
Exactly. And you're literally like not many miles away from each other, and it's like this or that. It's crazy.
I wouldn't, and they're both in the same league. Is that how that works? Like they both.
Yeah, they're both in the Premier League.
So you have one city that it'd be like, you know, like the Vancouver Canucks playing the Vancouver somethings. You know, it's like
Remember CFL? We had two teams named the Rough Riders. I mean, we only had 6 teams in the league. So I mean,
the Rough Riders are really sticking into these Rough Riders.
Well, it was the Rough Riders.
And the Rough Riders. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that.
And to join Nigel's logic in this, it's because the Ottawa Rough Riders were shit. See?
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. Just kidding. Anyway, no, okay, we got that out of the way. Now we can talk about the important things. Yeah,
that's funny. We normally talk about hockey. We went to footy.
We immediately went to football. Exactly, the most popular sport in the world, but we don't seem to talk about it ever in North America. Right. Funny.
Well, they're getting into it. It's pretty big in schools and all that. And
it always is. Yeah,
it's hard to compete with the world teams because Man United, Juventus, and all these teams, they're just like the same amount of money that the NFL spends. So you have an American team, and it's not going to win in the World Cup.
Unless they got someone like David Beckham on their team, then they're going to know.
Yeah.
They can't lose. Wait, did that work? Did that ever work? I don't know if that ever worked. Yeah.
You just did something.
Your mic got really loud. Your mic got really super loud, and it's distorting like crazy.
Oh, well, I wanted to do that on purpose.
And Nigel's about ready to pull out his hair because he can't find the mixing board to fix it.
Is that better?
No.
Is that better?
I don't know. Really? What happened. It's just, very strange.
Or I'll turn this down to...
Just start playing with knobs.
Is that better?
Play with your knobs. Go to the cam mic settings.
Yes.
And then go to audio. Sorry about this, everybody.
No, this is the they love this stuff.
And this is planned because we, it's all. Today,
I'll go to the toilet. I'll be back.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. Try automatically adjust mic volume. Is that checked?
How the hell do you see that? There it is. Okay. Automatically adjust. Okay, I'll just turn myself down. Is that better?
It's still distorting, though, so I wonder if you should just plug and unplug it.
Weird. Maybe. Not any better. Okay.
Nigel really did go off to the bathroom.
Hang on, I'm going to unplug and plug it in.
Yeah. Okay.
When in doubt, knock it out.
Yeah. Oh, and there goes the flush.
That was great.
This is like the scene from, what was that? Naked Gun?
I have to tell you guys a story. That was awesome, Nigel. We heard the flush and everything. So... I don't know if you remember the Hardy Hempel was the keyboard player in the Shania band, and he told us this story one time. He told us the story that they were in rehearsals and they all had headset mics on. And one of the girls, they took a break, and one of the girls went to the bathroom. She forgot to turn off her wireless pack and her headset. So she was in the bathroom with her microphone on. And you hear tinkle, 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 and then you hear the flush, and then you hear, "Oh my God, please go down. Please go down."
Didn't that happen down like some member of parliament or something? A mayor of some, I saw that on the internet a couple months ago. It was some US state. A guy did the same thing, walked away and had his mic on. And needless to say, it was.
It happens.
When I used to do the original, the first tour, I mean, Shania was on for 2.5 hours, I think. I get really anxious. I keep going before the show started. I just go to the toilet just in case, because once you're out there, you're screwed.
It's a long show. You gotta be well drained before you start.
Todd, did we get you back, or are you still?
Can you hear me?
Oh yeah, there you go.
Now it's your laptop mic.
Now it's the internal mic. Keep going. Do your thing. I'll figure it out.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, Nige, we got you here. It's awesome. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. And I wanted to ask you about I know a lot about you, but I don't know exactly how you got into being in the recording industry. So you were 17, and what did you just have a studio in town?
Full disclosure, I'm not a musician. I can't sing. I don't write music. So, everyone used to say in Manchester, how do you get in the music industry? I mean, you don't play an instrument. I go, well, it's a bit like the film industry. There's a lot of people there. They're not actors. They're behind the scenes and all that. And my brother was a musician, mm-hmm. and he got a record deal in 1975 in London with Charisma Records. And I'd you know, so I left school at 16. So I'm not going to college. So I get some kind of job there, and I'm messing around with Alan. He's got a four-track tape machine, and I'm doing his demos. And anyhow, he gets a recording contract, and it's just for a single, not an album. And he goes to Morgan Studios in London, and he phones me up, and he says, you know, come down, Nige, you know, check it out. It's the real world, you know. And so on the weekend, I drove down and went in there, and I was watching the session, and they were doing string overdubs. You know, it was a ballad that he was doing, and I was going, this is cool. You know, it's like it's amazing. You know, it's like the real world. And so I was there for the weekend, and Martin Levan, he became a very famous, he was a top engineer there, but he became a very famous person who designed sound for all the theater stuff for Andrew Lloyd Webber. He did all the, you know, all around the world. And nice guy. And I talked to him, he was the engineer on it. How'd you get a job in a place like this? And he said, well, it's kind of funny, really. Actually, we are going to be looking for someone. And he said, Chris Tangarides, I don't know if you know who he is. He's a famous producer. Chris Tangarides did Judas Priest.
Yes, Tim Lizzy,
I've actually got some notes here, so I can remember. So what is it? Yeah, he did Gary Moore. You know, Tigers of Pang Tang. He did.
Oh wow!
Ingwe Malmsteen.
Oh nice!
He
I have all those records.
Well into that hard rock stuff, but he was the tape op, and he was being promoted to engineer. And they said we need someone to, you know, replace him. So he said, give us your information. We'll put your name in the hat, and we'll let you know. So I go back home, and a week later I get the phone call and said, well, you know, if you want the job, you start on Monday. So I had to quit my job that I was doing. I had to tell them that, you know, I was getting a really good wage at this job.
Well, what were you doing?
It was crazy. I ended up working for the Daily Mirror, publishing, you know, like the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And I was a messenger boy, you know, I was like a runner. And then somehow my mom knew someone there, and they got me a union card. It was all about getting a union card. And, this is before I knew. And the job I got was in the library department. I think the guy I replaced retired. It was like such a boring job. But actually, it was paid great, great money, you know. And so I go into them a week, you know, I said, I'm going to quit. And they said, oh, really? You know, giving up your union card. So what are you going to do? I'm going to London to work in, you know, a studio, and I'm going to get paid a quarter of the price I get paid here. I'm going to work four times the hours that I work here. And the guy's looking at me going, God, you guys, you kids are stupid. And so anyhow, that's what I did. I went down. I had this banger of a car, Vauxhall Viva. It was rusty, so I painted it. You know, I actually painted it with a brush. You know, it's like navy blue. You know, when you're 17, you think this is cool. You know, and so I drive down to London and stay with my brother, who's in South London in Putney, and I had to get to North West London in Willesden, where Morgan Studios was. And it's only like 5 miles, but it's like 45 minutes in the traffic. You know? And my car was a bit dodgy. The first few days I was working with Mark Levan, the first thing I worked on was a string section. And it was like, holy shit, you know, it's like. And like within that day, he had me editing the multi-track tape and all that. I couldn't do anything else. I knew nothing. I knew nothing. And I think the third day I arrived, I didn't arrive late. You're meant to, as a tape op, you're meant to do everything. You're meant to be there 2 hours before the session. You're meant to, you know, the engineers in those days were, you know, very successful, almost not superstars, but they were, you know, and they wanted tape ops who would just set everything up. You know, if it was a string section, all the mics, everything, everything set up, patched up into the mixing console, all written down and all the routing done, everything, so that if the engineer didn't turn up, you could actually do the session without him, you know. And so I arrived late for this big, like 60-piece orchestra thing, you know. It wasn't late. It was like half an hour, but you meant to be 2 hours before. And they just looked at me and they said, look, if you can't arrive on time, don't even bother coming tomorrow. You know? So I'm going, oh, shit, I'm going to get fired, you know. And I went home. These are sessions. You'd start at 10 and you'd finish at 12 and you do another session from 1 to 5. They're all structured and, you know, everything's 3 hour. And so I wasn't doing anything after that. I went home and Alan told him, and he was great. He gave me money to get a deposit on a car so I could go to a dealership that night and buy something that I wouldn't break down and I could arrive on time. So I had this new car. It wasn't new, it was secondhand. And I arrived there, and I'm on thin ice now. You know, it's like it's only a matter of time.
Back so to the daily mirror with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they go back with my tail between my legs. And so they put me with the chief engineer, Roger Quested, who he's known for Quested speakers. He did very well. But at the time, he was one of the top guys. And he was the guy who was going to whip you into shape. You know, if you could get past Roger, then you got the job. And so it was another orchestra session again. And I'm going, oh, shit, you know what I mean? So I get there 2 hours before, which I should do. And it's all set up. And I'm going, you know, because the engineers used to pitch up like 20 minutes before the session started. And everything's set up for them. You give them the tea, they have a newspaper, and you know, it's like, and it's all set up. And I'm going, wow, did he come in before me? And he didn't. He set it up the night before, but he did it himself, which is unheard of. Roger Quested would never do anything like that. And anyhow, he does come in early, and I'm just sitting there twiddling my thumbs. And he looks at me and he goes, man, I finished a session last night and I set everything up. I never do this, but I knew I was working with you and you knew nothing. And I just left one thing for you to do. I'm just going, what? And he said, the headphones, you didn't put any headphones over. So it was like 30, you know, whatever the instrumentation was. And I run downstairs and putting these headphones in and boxes and plugging them in. And all that day he was like, ripping me, you know. It's like, yeah, because the thing was, I did send a picture to Corey about the first tape recorder we were using. So we're doing 16 track in those days,
right?
And this machine was called a 3M M79 or whatever it was.
We'll show a picture of it here.
Yeah, and
it's the one with the six. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that was my hell hole. So that was, I mean, this machine sounded amazing. It sounded better than anything, you know, than Shooter and all that. But the transport was really, really vicious. And if it wasn't set up correctly, it could, you know, suddenly the tape would be spooling. It's like going on the floor. No. And then if it gained its tension again, it would pull back and snap and almost stretch it. So you always had to have someone, a tape op, in charge of it.
Yeah. And
in those days, everything was moving so fast with musicians. The engineer didn't have time. You know, that didn't really have a proper remote, but you wouldn't trust it. If that was in another room and you look back and the tape's all over the floor, you know. It's like, so you know, the tape op, that's where the tape op came from. And, you know, the main thing was to operate, make, you know, wind back, punch in, etc. And it was so funky, you know, it didn't, you know, it had a counter, but it would always slip. So, you know, if you do one take and they say, keep it, you know, you couldn't rely on the counter. So you get this chinograph marker thing and you'd mark it to say, you know, if you see that, you don't go past there because you can erase the song before, you know.
Oh.
Because you do a take and you couldn't afford to just keep everything. The tape was expensive. You'd wind back again. And so it was very... And also what happened was, because the engineer was divorced from that, you had the communication with the producer, and the producer would start saying, you know, second verse, bunch in after two bars, you know, for a couple of bars where he says this. And so the great thing about it was I was thrown in at the deep end. My first priority was not to get fired. And that meant you had to be as good as all the other tape ops. They were all experienced. So I realized with Roger, what I did, we had these books that we'd write, you know, we'd do sessions and we'd write, oh, I work from 9 to 12 on string section, which so-and-so, write it. And this is all to make sure I got paid correctly. You know, they kind of trusted the tape ops to give them, you know. And I said, you know, oh, shit. So I used the back of the book and I said, right, I'm going to write everything down that all the engineers expect and need. So Roger Quest did string section. I knew already he used Schertz mics, which was a German model. Most people use Neumann 87s, 47s, 84s. He hated Schertz. He hated Neumann. So he had these Schertz that were for the violins and violas, and they used C12s, which is like the power pack, the tube version of the 414 for the celli and the bass. And so I wrote it all down. You know, I knew exactly what Roger would use. Martin Levan was different. It was 87s for violins, violas, and celli would be 47s. And then the drum kit would be the drum kit. Roger would mic every tom separately, but he, again, no Neumanns. I can't remember what he was using for toms. Carrack for snare, C12s for cymbals. But Martin Levan, it would be you 87s. But one thing, so when you're 16 track, it's like nothing. So you can really only use 5 tracks of drums.
Wow.
So it was like kick, snare, and then stereo kit, which would be toms and cymbals, and then hi-hat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I was thinking, now, why did they separate the hi-hat, really? Was it that important? But, you know, I suppose disco was around at the time as well. So that was kind of you needed to EQ it and get it a certain way. Mike Boback, who did all the Rod Stewart stuff, you know, he just used four tracks. So when you think about it, 5 tracks, then you put a bass down at 6. Then you've got a stereo Rhodes or some sort of keyboard thing. So that's 7, 8. You're halfway through.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, it's, yeah.
Then you got
it's
two
almost
guitars,
no tracks. I mean, considering that guitars, you have unlimited tracks now.
Yeah,
in the old days, it was 16.
Yeah, so you got a vocal, it's 11. You want background vocals, it's 13, 14. You've only got 2 tracks left.
So was there a great deal of bouncing going on in that world?
Totally, yeah. Well, yeah. You had to get the drum sound the way it should be because there's nothing you could do with... Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a funny story with Roger. It's like, because engineers were very, technical and they came from that area. And a lot of the times producers came from the music side and they didn't understand all the tech. Nowadays it's all merged. Everyone kind of knows everything. And Roger was, saying, well, we don't have any tracks left to do this last thing. And the guy gets a £50 note and goes, you can find me a track. And he said, okay, I'll just raise the vocal then, you know. So the funny thing is going from 16 and then we had 2 studios with 24 track, so you can imagine another 8 tracks. It was like, wow.
Of course, like, yeah,
luxury, you know. And I was saying to Corey before, it's amazing how as technology got, you know, they wanted more tracks. They never went past 24 tracks on analog. But it changed the way recording was done. So, you know, in the days I was doing these sessions, it was sessions and it would be a 3-hour session. You'd get three songs done in 3 hours, the backing track, and then you have lunch. And then in the afternoon, you do overdubs like background vocals, maybe fix the vocal or do the vocal again. And, you know, you might, if it needs strings, you probably you wouldn't mix it that. If it didn't need strings, you'd probably mix it that night. So you get 3 songs done in a day. If you need strings, then you book the strings the next morning and the brass in the afternoon. And then So everything was really quick. And it's amazing. You know, I mean, the other thing about it is it was saying, you know, in those days, I never went to college, but like nobody went to college. It's like in these things, it's all about trade. So you went to college if you were, you know, a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer. But, you know, you didn't go to college to go in the studios. You just worked. You just got your foot in the door and worked with them. And
right,
just,
right.
So you must have had a lot of stressful moments in the beginning learning the ropes. And was there holy shit moments?
No, you know, well, it was all holy shit for the first 2 weeks. It was like, how the hell am I going to survive? But, you know, the beauty is...
Like recording over something and going, oh, my God, I just recorded over
this. No. That was the thing.
That's amazing.
You can't have that, you know. But the point is they realized I was trying, and that was the key. You know, they go, well, at least he's trying. Right. So in the end, I actually got good. I could set everything up for everyone. And then that's when I considered myself useful.
How long does it take before you've kind of got it? Like before they started giving you a hard time?
4 weeks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go.
That's pretty good.
No, because basically, you know, they're not going to have you hanging around if you can't get it together. You know?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
And so how many years did you do that before you got your first like big sort of gig?
Well, like I said, the beauty is within 6 months, if the engineer didn't pitch up, I could record the session. I wouldn't necessarily know how to balance it or mix it. You know, I could balance it, but I wouldn't be a mixing expert or anything like that. But I knew I could record it. And I think I was there 2.5 years, and I did an Andrew Lloyd Webber thing. It was an album, and it was Tell Me on a Sunday. And it was like... It's, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber, that time you could have sang Three Blind Mice and it would have gone in the, you know, like whatever. So I actually got a hit. So, but I didn't count it because it was Andrew Lloyd Webber. And like I said, we could have done anything.
So this was cool. All at Morgan Studios?
Yeah, Morgan Studios, yeah. And the first hit I had after that was this guy called Jonah Louie. I just left Morgan. And he was with Stiff Records, and it was called Stop the Cavalry, and it was it was a pop song, and, you know, it got number three or something. So, but, you know, the weirdest thing is, in those days, I mean, so, you know, to explain the studios in London then, it was a small business in the sense that there was probably 20 studios. When I say 20 studios, 20 companies. We had 4 studios at Morgan. You know, Abbey Road had 3, I think, and Olympic had 2. And but there would be like 20 studios that were doing all the records in the charts in England and everything. And so the amazing thing about it is pretty much all the time you were working on something that was well-known. You know, like, for instance, I did write stuff down. So you had Olympic Studios, which is Rolling Stones, The Who, Zeppelin. Glyn Johns was... Jimi Hendrix Experience and all that. Abbey Road, we know, was the Beatles. Pink Floyd did Dark Side of the Moon. Basing Street was Chris Blackwell, who had Island Records, and it was Bob Marley, all the Bob Marley stuff. And U2, they groomed U2, Steve Winwood, Robert Palmer, Grace Jones. And those Bob Marley records, I listen to them now, they sound amazing. I mean, they still sound great. So you had Wessex Studios, which is where Mike Shipley was. That was Queen, The Pretenders, Sex Pistols, The Clash. So you had producers like Roy Thomas Baker, Mike Stone, Chris Thomas, and Bill Price was the engineer. you got Air Studios, which was where George Martin used to do the Beatles. He broke from EMI, and he said he had 3 different studios, but one of them was an Oxford Circus, and that was Paul McCartney, Roxy Music, Dire Straits. And then we got Trident, was the cool one. That was Tony Visconti, and he did T-Rex. And eventually David Bowie was, you know, and Elton John with Gus Dudgeon in that. So the studio I was in was Morgan. And all Rod Stewart stuff was done there, Maggie Mae onwards, all Cat Stevens stuff. And Jethro Tull, yes, Topographic Ocean, Thin Lizzy, you know. So it was amazing. And then Mickey Mouse was this producer in England at the time, was like you know, like the equivalent of Mutt Lang later, but, you know, in the early days.
Right.
And he had his own record label, Records, and he did the Animals, House of the Rising Sun, and you know, we're doing Susie Quattro.
Nice.
And
what was her name on Happy Days? Leather Tuscadero. That was it. Yeah.
So, and Hot Chocolate, and the cool thing about Mickey Most, he used to just come in and do singles. He never really took the studio out to do an album or anything. Huh. So it was always instant, and within 2 weeks, you'd hear it in the charts. You know?
Amazing. Wow. Okay, so let's fast forward now to when you first met Mutt. How did you get to work with Mutt? Was it at Morgan, right, or?
Yeah, so Morgan had four studios, and it's kind of funny, you know, because it's, so Morgan's heyday was before I got there. You know, it was still doing really well when I was there, but it was the 70s when all this stuff with Cat Stevens and, you know, Jethro Tull was doing an album when I was there, and Peter Gabriel did an album there. And but a lot of the big stuff, that, you know, all the Rod Stewart stuff was done earlier. And it's, you know, it's a fashion business. Even, you know, you're as good as your last record, and Morgan, and, you know, they all had this reputation of having these artists there. But, you know, punk came along and, like, wiped that out in a day. It was literally, we were standing outside the studio going, you know, Sex Pistols signed three different record contracts in 1 week. I think it was EMI and then A&M, and they got kicked off the label each.
That's right.
They ended up with Virgin Records.
That's right.
And we were going, and every time they got kicked off, it's because they went into they went into Abbey Road Studios and kind of tried to trash it. They had fire extinguishers going off in the room. They said, "Fuck this, you're gone," you know. It's like, and it was an image thing. It was Malcolm McLaren, the manager, and it was, you know, we're sitting there going, "We're not part of that. We don't have any punk going on there." And all we realized was overnight, Elton John, Rod Stewart, Queen, gone.
You couldn't
get arrested on the radio station. It was all the Clash, Sex Pistols, the Jam. It was just like a whole new thing had changed overnight. Hmm. And we were going, where does that put us? You know, like, is the studio? And the studio kind of started going down a bit. And we had rumors that they were going to sell one of the studios. And we didn't believe it. We were like, yeah, right, it's just a rumor. But they were. And they sold Studio 4 to Zomba, which is Clyde Calder, and that's Mutt used to work, was part of the Zomba thing. They managed him, and he was, you know, part of the whole thing. And so they sold the studio, and Mike Shipley and Mutt, Mike Shipley and Mutt looked at the studio, and then Mutt, you know, they decided we should have this. And so Mike Shipley's there, and he's the main engineer, the only guy. And there's Joyce Moore, who was the studio manager of Wessex, where he came from. And she became the studio manager. They called it Battery Studios. It was Studio 4 for Morgan, but it was Studio 1 for Battery. And I was sent over there just to show them, you know, the ropes, where everything was, because it was part of Morgan. You know, they had to use our maintenance guy, and I just went out. And they didn't even have a tape of or anything. And
So Mike and Mike were already working together at this point.
No, they weren't. No,
they weren't.
They had at Wessex, but he wasn't engineering for him. Tony Platt was working with Mutt as an engineer at the time.
And Mutt had already done AC/DC and
he'd done Highway to Hell. But then Highway to Hell was with Neil Kernan, and then Tony Platt did Back in Black with Mutt at Compass Point. So I go over there to, you know, show them, you know, well, here's the tea, here's the coffee, the cups are there, all the important stuff, you know. And they don't have a tape op, so I start working with Mike, you know, because the amazing thing about Zomba was Clive and Ralph, and Clive was a genius. He could just sell, they could sell ice cream to Eskimos. So this studio that they sold was, it wasn't even a third full. It was like empty most of the time. So Morgan, you know, the graphics, within, as soon as Zomba got it, it was like they had three bands waiting to get into the set.
Wow.
And of course, Mike was the engineer, and it was like solid work. So I ended up working with Mike. And then after a few weeks, we got on great. And, you know, Mike was brilliant. I mean, I worked with some great engineers, Martin Laban and, you know, Roger Questy was great. And there was, you know, Mike Bobek. And, but Mike was from it was a different thing. And it was a new thing to learn. And his standards were really high. And you just wanted to, you know, he just encouraged you to, you know. So it was great. We got on great, and they offered me a job. And I saw what was going on at Morgan. I thought, well, it's like diving over there. So I jumped over to Zomba, and that's how we met Mutt. Eventually, Mutt comes in and doing a project with Tony Blatt. And,
which project was that?
Oh, God. The name was Dickin. But I can't.
Interesting. Huh.
It wasn't something that was a massive hit, but it was the first engagement with Mutt, and that was
okay.
So you know, like now so you got your Mike Shipley, you got the bar up there, and you're going up, and then Mutt comes and just goes, "Where did the bar go?"
It's out of sight.
Right. Yeah, so
that's amazing. So then, how long before you started doing the first Def Leppard thing with Mutt?
Well, it was High and Dry. I was on High and Dry as a
wow.
Tape Off.
That's a good one.
Okay. And Tape Off is also synonymous with assistant engineer, is it?
Yeah. So originally, like I said, the Tape Off, I was operating, you know, they didn't have remotes and they called you the Tape Off, but you did everything. Yeah. You set everything
you patched the patch bay and you set up mics and
everything. But the idea was you were operating the tape machine, punching in and all that. As right. It got later on, you had Studer machines that were much more accurate, and you could, as an engineer, use a remote. You didn't need the Tape Off to be. In the early days, that machine I showed you was kind of like pretty
out. Right. And you were saying that good Tape Offs could actually know by how fast it was spun, how far to rewind back.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah.
You needed to go 10 seconds, you go, okay, that's it, 10 seconds, just by the feel of it.
Yeah, yeah, you'd be on the machine all the time. It was just like anything. It's, yeah, I mean, that, yeah.
Like,
I mean,
go back to the first course, you would know how to get there without
Actually, what we did with that, we did put a bit of code with ChinaGraph. You do it a certain way, course, verse, you know. But most of the time, you know, in those days, you weren't really punching in as much as you were once you got into the 80s. Which then you're punching in beats and syllables and things. But then it was more like, you know, so it wasn't so. But I mean.
Okay. That's really cool. So let's talk about working with the Leopards.
Yeah, there was a Leopard. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us everything.
That's like, that's Pete Willis in the band. That's. Rick's got both arms at the time. It's a whole different Def Leppard at that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very so, young man.
High and, yeah. Yeah. And High and Dry. It was them in the studio battery, and Mike was doing it, and I was tape hopping. And And at the time, I was starting to get, because Clive, you know, he bought in, you know, he's a publishing and he wanted to start a production company. He already managed producers. You know, we had Martin Birch, Tony Platt, Tim Freeze Green, Mutt, who else? Anyhow, but the idea was for them eventually to start a record company, which became Jive Records. So, you know, Clive wanted a studio available for him when he wanted it, but he didn't want it to be locked up. And right. Mutt always had this reputation of taking a long time on records. And I think when Pyromania happened, they started a battery, but it was pretty obvious it was going to take maybe a year. So Clive just wanted access to the studio. So I think there was an agreement. Mutt decided to go to Hastings Battle, a studio called Pargate Studios. And he recorded the guitars there himself with engineers there, and that freed Battery One up, and I was doing some stuff in Battery Two. Now they bought the second studio,
I had a question that we were talking about a little bit last week. We all know that Jim Steinman passed away last Tuesday on the show.
Oh, boy.
And we all know that you were involved in Def Leppard's biggest album to date, Hysteria, if not one of the biggest records of the decade. And if it's not common knowledge, it will be today that, and correct me if I'm wrong on my information here, but from what I understand, Mutt was kind of taking a break just due to exhaustion. Yeah. He'd probably been overly worked.
Yeah.
And they brought in Jim Steinman as the original producer on that album. Were you in the room on that? Did you get to hear on that? No, because I've read interviews with Joe Elliott that says that that will never see the light of day. And I was just curious to know
Neil Dorfman, he did the Dire Straits. Great engineer.
Oh, okay.
No, wow. So yeah, the whole thing was Mutt, you know, so we're from High and Dry, and then on Pyromania, Mutt decided to put drums on last, which, you know, you go, what? And
weird.
So, but it was about having the ability to change, because they wrote while in the studio. So they wanted to change things. You know, if they thought the chorus could be better, they just, you know, just, right, we'll do another, you know, like you can. I did an article on this on their site. And, you know, now you can do that with Pro Tools easily. You can just, you know, just change the middle eight, whatever. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't do that. If you put the drums down first, you know, like you normally do, then you're kind of stuck with the arrangement. You can't really change it, you know. And he wanted that ability to change. And so Pyromania was done that way, and it became a great success. But when Hysteria happened, they wanted to do it the same way. But the problem is, I did this Cars album with Martin. That took a year. Everything seems to take a year. And and Mutt was I was burnt out. We were all burnt out, and Mutt was burnt out, and he made a decision then that he wasn't going to do the Def Leppard album, which, you know, because he'd literally from, I mean, before I even started in the studio business, he did the Boomtown Rats. I was still at school, and that was going number one and all that. He was doing amazing stuff then. So he constantly worked, and there was always another project ready to go. He never took time off, so he decided he wasn't going to do the next Hysteria.
I bet he's glad he did.
Well, he's instrumental in a lot of the success. I mean, it, you know,
I'm curious to know how that would have turned out without him. I mean, that has just been one of those albums that is just almost like a signature sound, right? I mean,
The Jim Steinman chapter adds to the entire length of that process, because they clearly tried to make the record in one. And then
the length of the songs, too. I mean, I bet you I Pour Some Sugar on Me would have been like 12 minutes. You know, it's like, you know,
let me sleep on it. Pour some sugar. Let me sleep on it.
So anyhow, the whole thing was Steinman wanted them to just go in the studio and bang it out, you know, and they never did. Even High and Dry, we were putting the drums down first, and that was the human click sort of thing. He was like, you know, he's just like hilarious.
He was clapping.
Listening to a click.
But there was no click track. There was no real click track, or
was, but he was in a vocal booth listening to a click, and he's going one, two, three, and first, two, three, and, you know, it's like, so he was like trying to make a click track with a vibe, so that the drummer would not just sort of become this metronome. He wanted them and push, two, three, and, but, you know.
So conducting, in a sense.
Conducting, yes, yeah. Exactly. He was a conductor. So it was
quite interesting and fascinating. Cool.
Yeah. So that was done that way. So all the albums they did with Mutt were done in this strange way. It wasn't them going in the studio and banging it down. And Jim Steinman wanted to do that, and they were going, well, we don't do it that way.
Wow.
So they realized after, I think it was 6 months, I don't know what it was, and they said, no, this isn't working. So Clive, you know, I was, you know, doing stuff for Jive and all that, and Mutt, and they said, oh, send Nigel over there. And I was under the impression that I was going there to mix it and do some vocal overdubs. I didn't think I was going over there to produce an album. And it appeared that there wasn't many tracks available. It was like three tracks, and it wasn't even that great, you know. And it was like, oh, shit. So technically, I was over my, I was, you know, beyond my capabilities. And we struggled for a while. We were trying to beef the guitars up and things. And it's still to a click track. And then, you know, terribly, Rick had the accident, lost his arm. Mm-hmm. We went back for Christmas. Yeah. And I read on the newspaper, I'm flying back on January the 2nd, I think, picture of Rick, you know, lose his arm. And I'm going, what? And I, you know, we didn't have cell phones in those days. So I had no contact with anyone. I just flew to Whistle Lord Studios in Holland, and nobody
was
there.
What are we looking at here, Nigel? Is this
that's one of the Ireland? So they did it in two studios. They did it in Windmill Lane in Ireland. And well, they did it in three studios, but they were doing it in Whistle Lord with Jim Steinman, and I went there, and then Rick had the accident, and then we went to Paris to do more work there. And Paris was just really expensive, and we knew it was going to take forever. So
when Phil wore a shirt.
yeah.
That's when Phil was the new guy.
Paris. Yeah, that's Paris.
Yeah.
So we said, why are we here? You know, so Joe said, well, I've got a place in Ireland and we can get a studio for next to nothing there, you know. So we said, that's what we need. This is going to take forever to do. We don't need a studio that's costing £300 an hour, you know.
Because you were in Paris originally, it was costing way too much. And
oh, astronomical. Right? We were staying in the Champs-Élysées in a hotel. It's like,
great. Wow.
And Joe, I was speaking to Joe. Joe said, do we need to? And I said, no, I've been trying to get a cheap studio. It's like in Paris. He said, well, in Ireland, we can go to Windmill Lane, and we don't even use their main studio. We use a jingle studio. And that's what we did. We went there. So those pictures were with the free.
Show that photo of Joe getting coffee there.
That was in Paris.
Yeah. That was Paris. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was Paris there.
Yeah.
The signature do. He's stuck with that one still to today, right? I
mean, yeah, the mullet, right?
Yeah. Okay, and he's time not frame.
Now.
What year around?
I'm trying to think. I think it was 86 when I started with them, or 85. So it's around there. I don't know. I'm not sure when the album was released. 87? I can't remember. That was right at the beginning. That was the first year. Well, yeah, before Mutt arrived, the tea thing.
Yes. And so tell us that story. You're talking about Rick losing his arm.
Yeah.
And that was around the time when Mutt came in, right?
Yeah, well...
and it was because of that Mutt came in, or no?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he realized... I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask Mutt, but I think he realized, first of all, we were struggling, and secondly, he felt, you know, I mean, everyone felt awful about the whole Rick thing, so he decided, screw it, I'll come in and do it, you know, so...
And he was the one that sort of told Rick that he could do it with only one arm, right?
Yeah. He went to the hospital, and you know, this guy's 21. He's lost his arm. You know?
Wow.
And said, and this is what's amazing about Mutt. Everything you do with him, you always push the boundaries. You always do something that people go, "What are you doing?" You know. And then later on, it's what everyone else does in the end. You know. So he goes, you know, you could get some electronic triggers, and if you transpose what you do with your, I think it was which arm, left arm, I think it was the one that went, put that to your foot, then that could be the snare and the kick, and then you've got, like, the other arm, you can do some cymbal smashes and toms, you put some delays on it, and you can, and Mutt had it all figured out.
And that's exactly what he did, pretty much, to this day, really.
They got someone to, build a kit. And that was all Rick needed to hear, was he could still play drums. You know,
wow.
He wanted to know.
Wow. Amazing. To think about that too, I mean, to take away anything positive from such a horrible, accident, that drum sound almost became, again, synonymous with the latter half of the 80s. I mean, it was just... Yeah. Almost, like you wouldn't even have known that was an accident that kind of prompted that.
You would think Rick would be a massive inspiration to anybody who had any kind of handicap to continue playing at that level.
No, he is.
It's massive.
He is a big inspiration. He does a lot of, But you think about it, you know, it's crazy. Drummer loses an arm, but if you're a guitarist.
Yeah, then you're in trouble. Yeah, completely.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the funny thing is though, I've never, you know, things cease to amaze me every time I go online. You see a YouTube video of some kid playing with his foot or some person I remember being a kid and just trying to, you know, perfect the F chord and just going screw this and throwing it because it's just too hard. Right. And then you see these people that are playing with their feet and it is amazing, you know, the obstacles that some people overcome just due to persistence. And I think, yeah, absolutely. What an inspiration that would be to
of course,
to
it's
any
another
musician.
Thing to have been playing drums for 21 years or whatever chunk of those years, and then suddenly have that removed from your arsenal. And like you said, we kind of forget how young those guys were. They were really young.
And I'm surprised that there wasn't a segue. I mean, normally that would lead to depression and, you know, possibly, you know, any type of substance abuse. I mean, you're in that kind of position. I mean, the fact that he kind of went right back into it that soon, and
they got a guy to design the drums. He was, when we were doing the album, he'd be in the other, we booked another room for him. He'd be practicing, and he'd get this thing together, and then go, "Mark, come and check this out." And he was so proud to show how he was doing. And so that was the inspiration, you know. It was
amazing.
I'm going to get back. And I don't know if you know this. I wasn't there, but live. You know, they had, I've forgotten the drummer who, they had a drummer from the band, can't remember, but they were touring with Leps, but Rick was there with them. And, you know, they were doing it together. And then one day the drummer just didn't make it. And they start the show, I think it was like Donington or somewhere. And Rick just does the show and the band don't realize that the other drummer's not there. Huh. And they turn around and it's just Rick doing it.
Wow, how was that? Yeah.
It was like the audience just stood up.
Of course, yeah. No, it's amazing. And like you say, after all that tragedy and, you know, trying to make a record once already, and then for that record to go on to be, well, it's one of the biggest of all time, period. Yeah. What a triumph.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Matt's so focused in that area. He's, you know, it was always about, we have to have six singles. That was the, with anything he did, whether it was Foreigner or whether it was AC/DC, got to have six singles.
Yeah.
And you bury the singles. You don't make them like a pop record. It is a pop record, but you bury them. You put the rock tracks in front. But at the end of the day, each time a single comes out, it keeps the album up there.
It does.
And let's not take away from the fact that that band has earned my respect time and time over, because it would have been just as easy for them at that point in their career to replace the drummer, you know, and they chose to stick with him and those guys, you know, and, you know, I just think that's, you know, the most commendable thing as a band. I mean, that's the definition of being in a band. And it was just, you know, one of those things that.
Well, the other thing, Steve Clark dies, you know, and I know, like, that's, I think, crazy. Bill Collins said, you know.
Right.
He was about to quit, you know, but they didn't. Yeah. They just, you know.
Right. Yeah, I can't imagine. They've had a hell of a history, and they're still going, God bless them, sounding as good as ever.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I saw them. Yeah. I hadn't seen them for 30 years. Corey knows. I hadn't seen them for 30 years. And
wow.
I think, well, you know, the weird thing is you were just working in the studio solid. I mean, you're on the next project. And, you know, you work with bands, and then you'd only see them when they come back, you know. And I just lost touch with them. And then they came to Denver, and I got hold of, well, it was because of I did this article. I never did articles or anything like this about fans or anything to work with, because in those days it was kind of like, you know, you kind of kept it quiet. You know, it's like, nowadays everyone's bloody Facebooking.
Yeah.
You didn't do that. You didn't take pictures or anything. But Billboard contacted me and they said, it's 30 years since Hysteria came out. Would you be prepared to do an interview? And I said, oh, I don't do interviews. And then I went, 30 years. And it was like, blew my mind. And I phoned Mudd up and I said, you know, they've asked me to do an interview. Should I just ignore it? And he said, oh, no, I'll do it. I said, well, I have to tell the whole story about it. You know, I'm not going to make, you know, because we did things very controversially, like drums last. And he said, no. He said, you've got to pass it by the band, though. You know, if the band don't want it, fine. So I wrote it myself, sent it to Mark. He said, yeah, that's good. Sent it to Dev. I got Phil Collins' email, and I sent it to him. And he phoned me up, and he said, where the fuck have you been? You know. and then we had a great chat for about an hour. You know, it was like talking about the old days. And he said, no, it's great. And I said, well, I can't give this to Billboard unless all the band members approve it. You know, it can't be just you. You know, I don't know if Joe likes it. You know,
sure.
And I couldn't. You know, eventually, it's okay now. Rick got hold of me, and Sav got hold of me. So there's three of them at least.
Looking very savage there.
I'll find that article, Nigel, and we'll put up a link to that article.
Yeah, you should.
Really great.
I'm about to read that. Yeah.
I'm just trying to find it here.
Well, and you know, just because obviously we could spend an hour on every album, and you've got such a legacy. Just some of the questions coming in. I mean, just to kind of segue into some of the other bands you were working with.
Yeah.
Was the experience working with Def Leppard, was that kind of what alluded to a lot of the other bands that you worked with in the 80s? I mean, some of the big names like Iron Maiden. I mean, you've done a number of albums with them. Is it?
We were part of a production company. I worked with Zomba, and Zomba was a publishing company that before we even bought the studio, they had signed up all the publishing of AC/DC, Iron Maiden, everyone. Clive was genius. He was way ahead. And so already we had producers. Martin Birch was a producer for Zomba, and he was producing Iron Maiden. So we'd bring them into the studios, and that's how I got to work with them, because it was all part of an in-house kind of production thing. So, it was a lot to do with Zomba, and
And then, of course, because we always like to hear the great stories, not to take away from the whole, you know, engineering and the audio, but I mean, those bands in the 80s, I mean, we all know, like you said, I mean, kind of similar to what you're talking about with the punk guys. What was it like working with these bands at the height of their careers? I mean, you know, in the middle of the 80s, was any good studio stories you can tell us?
Trying to think. I have studio story. I have to be careful with, like I said, with talking
about non-disclosure, right?
Ozzy Osbourne. These are safe ones. Like this is in Morgan. So I was working with Gary Moore with Martin Levan in Studio 3, and Ozzy was Chris Tangerides doing Sabbath in Studio 4. And we were just like, and the thing with Morgan Studios that they had a bar restaurant, and we used to gather for lunch, and so we'd all like talk with each other, and then we'd go off and do our own projects. And it was a real nice vibe. I think that's something that's lost nowadays. You know, the studio environment isn't that way, I don't think. But we do joke. You know, we're just stupid kids. You know, we do jokes like a tape op would always say, "You got a C12? I've got one over here. I'll come over and get it." And every studio door had a security camera to see you buzz them in. And somehow we balanced this egg something so that when the tape op came in, it hit him on his head or something. I don't know how we did it, but so we got Ozzy's, you know, tape op. So Ozzy said, well, got to get him back for that, you know. So he comes over in the afternoon. And he jumps on top of the roof and he throws stink bombs down the air conditioning unit. And like we're running out of the studio going, you know, we couldn't do anything for us. But I tell you, with Morgan Studios, I was tape op and they became big chief tape op. And Martin Levan became studio manager. And in those days, like I said, you just became a tape op and they threw you in the deep end and they go, is he still there? And still alive, okay. So it was a quick learning curve. So Trident students used to have tea boys, and it was a better way of doing it. You know, they didn't throw them in the deep end. You'd make tea first, and you could learn what a tape machine is. So Mike Levan said, we're going to get tea boys, and you're the chief engineer, and I want you to interview some guys. So I had this friend, Mark Freegard, who was a tape op with me. We're good friends. And we thought, you were about 19 years old, you know. I go, oh, this is great. We're chief, you know, like we're part of the corporation now. We can interview people. So we were at the top. We had this desk and all this, and we get these young kids coming in, you know, 16, 17 years old. And one of them was Flood, who became famous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we interviewed two guys that day. One was Flood and one was Drought. and they weren't called that then. And anyhow, you could tell when you meet, you know, this Flood actually was a bass, I think he was a bass player, but he had a small, you know, and he was doing little production things himself. And so we thought, yeah, this guy's got it. So, but then we asked, you know, we're going to go, you know, this could be fun. So we said, right. So there's one thing we do have to ask you. And what? Have you ever smoked marijuana? And he goes, you could see me. What kind of question is that? You know, and we're giving me mouth. And he said, and he's looking at a recording studio, right? Yeah. And he went, yeah, you got the job. So anyhow, he became great at making tea. He was brilliant. He made too much tea, so they nicknamed it Flood.
That's why it's called Flood.
Yeah, and the other guy didn't give a shit. He didn't do anything.
Didn't make any
drought. Yeah. He was drought. Yeah. So it proves that if you're a good tea maker, you know, you go far. And drought, where's he?
I love that. You know, tea is a very important part of the English recording experience.
Exactly. And
it's still lost on us over here. Going
well, I'm sure it's the same with you guys with coffee, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But no one really. You know, I just think that's really interesting. That actually brings me to how does a guy like yourself end up in America? I mean, what's the process?
Well, it was Zomba again. You know, Zomba was going to expand. It was Jive Records. So I started doing all the early Jive Records stuff. And that's how I ended up doing R&B. But then when I worked with the producers, I'd be working on rock. And then Clive, again, being the genius as he was, he was the one who said, rap's going to be big. And no major record label in America wanted to know about rap. It was Run DMC, who was on Def Jam. But that was it, you know. And so we started doing rap. We got, you know, Thomas Dolby did the first thing. He wasn't really into rap. He didn't quite like how that ended up at the time. But we got these two guys from New York, or Clive did, and it was called Houdini. And they rapped on top of it.
Yeah.
And we did the record, and it just became an underground club kind of hit thing. So we were doing all this rap stuff as well. So it just basically became very – I could do all different types of things because I would be either working with rock producers like Martin Birch or Mutt, or I'd be doing stuff for Clive.
And that brings up an interesting question as well, because I mean, I know that as a musician, I mean, I guess as a studio musician, you get called in to do various styles of music, and you've got to kind of always just bring your A game. You go from working a large period of your life with, you know, with mostly these rock bands and stuff. And then I'm just reading some of your credentials. You go into something like Baby One More Time. I mean,
exactly.
I guess it's really just kind of a different headspace, right? You still approach it with the same professionalism, but what is the takeaway there?
Well, the hardest one was coming from rock back to R&B, because R&B, they have everything tight and it's all like, you know, and I'd have the cymbals smashing like a rock band, and they're going, hey, cool it. We're doing R&B here, you know. But in the end, it's just pop, you know, and hits. And you know, what I used to do all the time, I mean, you know, I was, so let me explain it. When I first started engineering stuff, I always wanted self-approval, like, is this good enough? I was always trying to. And the thing that actually made me realize I could do it was Tim Freeze Green. He'd done this record for Clive, and I was working with him. I was assisting, and it was a pop record, and I can't remember what it was, but they took the phone number from Buckingham Palace and put it on the record, like, it's, you know. And Clive said, you can't have that. You know, we're going to get like sued or whatever. We can't have Buckingham Palace. So, and Tim Freeze Green had gone on another project somewhere. And Clive, Nigel, you got to remix it. And I'm going, remix Temporary's Green thing? He's not going to like. So I go in the studio and I just all day I'm A-B-ing between Tim's mix and what I'm doing. I'm trying to get all the panning and the EQ right. And I'm trying to make it sound like Tim's mix. And I eventually get it really close. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, then if it is close, if it really is close, I should be able to edit it in. I should be able to edit that part in and
right.
tell the difference. So I did. I edited it in and I thought, I think that's okay. And Martin Levan happened to be walking around and I told Martin what I did. I said, you know, I don't want to. And he said, what you edit? He said, wow, that's pretty good. And the beauty was now I could deliver the record to Clive. I didn't have to worry about Tim saying I screwed his mix up because it was all his mix apart from this couple of bar section where the telephone number was.
You actually cut the tape out and put it on his master.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I realized, holy shit, if I can do that, then I actually can mix, you know, I can actually do it.
That's awesome.
And that's what I used to do. I used to compare all the time. I used to put, you know, like, so if I was doing Britney Spears, I put what's current on, listen to it, and then compare mine to it. If it didn't, you know, I'd keep trying to improve it, you know. And I'd even copy ideas, you know. David Bowie would have an amazing drum sound on, I think it was some stuff Clear Mountain was doing, and I got great having the drum sound on the thing I'm doing like that. So I'd copy the drum sound, you know. Like
yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah.
So it's obvious you like to critique albums. What's your opinion of Corey's job on the Took records?
Well, I heard the latest thing. No, he's great. It's great. Your stuff. Yeah. I heard.
We can take him out of the feed here if you want to talk honestly.
He taught me everything I know.
So, yeah.
Is it hard to find a good T-boy in America? Let's be honest. Let's get to the.
I don't even know if they know what it is now.
Is it actually?
I think if you look for a T-boy now, you might get something that you weren't expecting.
Exactly. They say go to Thailand for that.
Hey, Nigel, let's talk about the Bryan Adams album, Waking Up the Neighbors, because that was, you know, obviously a great record, but it was also the moment in history when Mutt first sees Shania on TV and starts up a relationship. He's like talking to her on the phone and he's saying like, yeah, I'm just recording a guy named Brian. And
some guy
downplayed the whole thing. She didn't even know who he was or what he had done.
To be honest, I wasn't there for that. I don't think that was on Waking Up the Neighbors. That was the album afterwards.
Oh,
that
really?
Because I was on the whole of Waking Up Neighbors, and yeah, that was before. Because that was Waking Up Neighbors was 91.
Okay.
And I think Shania was probably 95, 96.
Yeah, it would have been around then.
Yeah. So that would have been the album afterwards. So I wasn't there.
Okay. Okay. So incidentally, I texted with Keith Scott today, and he says to say hi to you. I tried to get him to drop in on us today.
Yeah,
but he speaks highly of you as well.
He was great. Like it was funny because, you know, he's not Vancouver. Where is he from? Is it Vancouver?
Yeah, he's Vancouver.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And anyhow, in England in those days, the pub, you know, I thought I'd take him to a pub. Me and Georgina, we took him to a pub in Wimbledon, and it's like Wimbledon in England is so quaint. You know? And on a Sunday, the pubs are only open for 2 hours. So I take him down there, and we're sitting, you know, in the Wimbledon lawn, whatever. And it's amazing, you know, like you had to get the last pint, you know, you could barely get two pints in because it was like, and he said, oh, I love it here. It's like a sport drinking.
So just out of curiosity, because, you know, totally off topic, why only 2 hours on Sunday?
Well, that's with the rule, 12 till 2. Yeah, I mean, it's all...
Like in the afternoon or 12 till 2 at night?
In the afternoon.
Wow.
In
the afternoon, yeah. So your last call
was
like...
Yeah, so that's... He was right. It was like a sport. Yeah. You had to get down there and...
just and, pound them.
Yeah.
And you mixed Everything I Do, did you?
I didn't. Clear Mountain mixed the thing because, you know, Clear Mountain was his guy. You know,
did you record that?
I recorded it. yeah, recorded
the whole album. You there when Keith recorded his guitar parts for that song?
Yeah.
So that's pretty epic, right?
Yeah. Well, the best, the funny one was, because it was, it was the guy who was doing Robin Hood. He'd done all the musical parts for it.
Okay.
I've forgotten his name. He's passed away. And
Michael Kamen.
Michael Kamen. And he had his own musical director, piano player, and all this. And so it was so fun. it was hilarious. So he comes in, and he's real confident. And of course, you're working with Mutt. And so Mutt's trying to create the song. It's all from scratch. And he's trying to go, he's telling him, play this way, that way. And we're doing it to MIDI, so he's not doing it on an acoustic piano. We're doing it on a piano sound, recording it to a sequencer, so that this would be the bed with a click track for us to put the rest of the stuff, everything, guitars, everything. And so this guy's used to with Nightmare Cayman, banging it down in 10 minutes, a couple of takes, So he's on the sync for 5 hours, and he's nonplussed. He cannot believe he's 5 hours to do this piano part, and it's MIDI, And me and Phil, he was the programmer at the time, we're kind of laughing at him. We've seen this before, And Mutt said, "Yeah, that's great. It's good for a guide, anyhow." And McKay just. Because Mutt already decided he was going to use Bill Payne out of Little Feat to do the piano.
Oh, no.
and the guy was just, it was just, but we're used to that every day with Mutt, it was nothing new, but he had it, it was hilarious.
Well, so Nigel, that being said, you've worked on so many hits, and so many of the biggest songs that have ever come out. Mm-hmm. Two-part question for you, and feel free if you don't want to answer this. Any song that you were working on that became a hit that you didn't think was going to, like sitting there working and going, I can't believe, we're spending all this time on this, and then obviously went on to be a hit. And second part, a song that surprised you that did become a huge hit that you were working on. Any big moments in your career that stand out like that?
It's hard because, I'm trying to think. There's a lot of times, and it sounds like, what a hit is. But I did actually, when I was working on stuff, I go, for instance, Everything I Do, when it was finished, we always thought that was going to be a hit. And then I heard it in a shop, what it's like, a crappy speaker. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it sounds really slow. It sounds really, maybe it's not going to be a hit, And you always had confidence when you were working on a Mutt thing because he was so focused. And then it did become a hit, and it became massive in England. And it was good. That was a hit. But there was a bit of doubt then.
I always knew it was going to be that way.
Yeah. But a lot of the times, no. I mean, it's hard. I don't think I worked on – no. I mean, again, I worked on tons of stuff that wasn't a hit, So it's not like
–
you're not working on hits all the time. But a lot of the time I was – pretty thing. Oh yeah, that could be a hit. I'll tell you one thing though, which you might.
So one song that you thought might have been a hit that didn't become. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I tell you, the thing that's interesting, and it was working with Clive and Billy Ocean. We do Billy Ocean stuff, and we have a pretty clear thing. Yeah, this is going to be the hit. This is the song, Right. And Clive would go, "Well, we're submitting that one, but we're doing two others." And I'm going, why? It's pretty obvious this is the hit, right? And he said, yeah, well, maybe to you or maybe to me, but guess what? We have to sell this to the radio station. And right. You have pluggers. You have these guys who are professional. That's what they do. They plug records. And true. They get a reputation for themselves. Blessing I did was David Bowie or whatever. So they would get, these top pluggers, they might get 5 or 6 records. And they grade them themselves. And if you only give them the one you like, but they don't like it, you might be fourth behind David Bowie or someone.
Right.
So you have to let them choose. You give them, you choose. And then if they choose and they like it, they're more likely to plug your record. So it's a real interesting world.
It's quite political.
Yeah. But But again, it's all about people. You know, and that's what I learned with Mutt. You know, we'd spend ages on something for days, and then someone would come into the control room, and Mutt would chat with all, chatting and everything, and we'd play it, and then he'd go, and Mutt said, you know, I don't think this is right. And we go, what do you mean? He said, well, he wasn't that impressed. And I'm going, well, what does it matter about him? And he said, he's the general public. Not us.
Wow.
And so he was always watching for reactions. Yeah. So, and it's true. The general, that's really, you know, because people used to believe you could sell a record. You can't. If people don't like it, you can plug it as much as you want, but if people don't like it.
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
Hey, I've always wanted to ask you this question about the song Gods of War, the Def Leppard song.
Yeah.
Because you mixed that, right?
Yeah.
So it's my favorite Def Leppard song. And really? But I've always thought the one thing that I would have changed in that song is I would have got No, the mix is great. I always thought that it should have gotten to the chorus sooner.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Because the verses are so long and it gets in the first verse and then it starts the second verse again, right? Yeah. And it builds that tension. I love it. But was there ever any talk about that or, that you know of?
No. You know, the thing is, it was very, you see, we were doing pop records. That's what they were.
Yeah.
They weren't rock records.
Right.
But you had to be careful. If you come out with, you know, Animal and Love Bites and all the first few tracks, everyone's going to say, that's not a rock record. They sold out. It's a pop record. Oh. So Gods of War and Women, which were like, Women was like 7 minutes long.
It was that rock
meant back. To disguise the fact that this wasn't a pop record.
Ah, right.
And yeah. Gods of War was the same thing. You wanted this long sort of you know, rock thing, and the rock guys got into it. Meanwhile, a couple of songs later, you stick one of your hits in. So even the album order is very important. You know, because you're trying to set it up that even though we know this is a pop record, so the fans who despise that, you know, no, this is a rock record. Yeah, we start with Women and
right.
That album can't imagine a greatest hits record is what it
I
is.
I can't imagine that arrangement being anything like as if Mutt didn't like, you know, a fine tooth comb of the entire arrangement. That's completely
knowing the way
purpose.
He is, it was totally calculated, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Pyromania was the same. Yeah.
So, Corey, you're questioning Mutt's ability as a producer here. Is that what I'm hearing?
Uh-oh.
No. Don't start that, Darren. Don't start that.
Let me tell you, Gene.
Yeah. Now, Nigel, didn't you also say that Thomas Dolby did the keyboards on Hysteria?
No, he did the keyboards on
Pyromania.
Nope. Yes, Pyromania.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Really? Wow. Yeah.
But he didn't want to put his name on it, right?
He didn't, no. Well, Thomas Dolby was, you know, years later, you know, everyone wants to be involved in success. Yeah, but at the time, Thomas was trying to carve his thing. And
sure, yeah.
I don't want to be known as the rock. You know what I mean? So yeah. It was his
the heavy metal
vision
guy.
To be Thomas Dolby, which was different,
Did he have an alias that he used?
I think there was an alias on it,
Dolby Thomas, I think it was.
I think there is an alias, but I can't remember what it was.
Science!
Remember that song?
Yeah.
I love that stuff. Yeah. I love that stuff. He was he had a huge run too, old Thomas Dolby.
Absolutely. You know, we could keep you for hours and talking about this, but I mean, I'm sure you're a busy guy. And of course, you know, we love hearing all the stories and we'll have to have you on again, you know,
there's
and discuss
have to be
some
a
of the stuff. Yeah, definitely. Well, you just have too much of a career to cover in the hour and a bit that we usually
Heartbeat
do.
Heartbeat City alone is going to be a whole other episode.
Yeah, we haven't gone there yet.
Yeah.
So I mean, but, you know,
Billy
I know
Ocean, all that stuff. That would be great to talk about.
Billy
too.
Ocean, absolutely, yeah.
Did he ever consider Willie Ocean? That would have been a good name. Willie Ocean.
William Ocean?
Will Ocean. Was William, actually. Yeah.
I would imagine, yeah. It's funny that you brought that up, though, because when you mentioned earlier about, like, never really seeing anybody unless they came in the studio, because I remember a million times in my life I've recorded a record and you get real tight with the whole family group of it, and then you go, I'm walking out of the studio, it's like, great hanging out, bro, see you later, and you leave, and I realize as I'm leaving, somebody else is loading into that room, and these guys just stay there without sun, you know, and just kind of work through exactly. the night making magic. And I just thought, wow. So guys like yourself, yeah. is it tough to have like a family life? Is that what eventually you have to kind of step out of?
In those days, yeah, it was a nightmare. Yeah,
now yeah, because you don't have any free time at all. Yeah.
Yeah. In
those well, but days, you said you yeah. met your wife working on one of the records, right?
Well, so. That was the funny thing about it is, so you worked all the time. I mean, literally yeah. every day you would work. You might get like a week off in a year. Because the studio was way too expensive to be sat there idle, and there was only a few people. So you were, and on Def Leppard, when Mutt decided to do it, he, you know, because he'd made this decision that he was going to cool it and, you know, have a break. And then yeah. when he came on, he said, okay, I'll do it, but I'm having weekends off. Because he was building a house. Sure. He wasn't building it from scratch. He was renovating it. And he's putting the studio in the house, which is where we ended up mixing the record. And he needed to be at the weekends to organize this. And he just wanted a break. He didn't want to do it like we used to. So that's the first time in my life.
That seems like a fairly civil way to work. Yeah. I mean, like you say, yeah. that kind of like, because I went through that for a while where I'm just going to get into making records and then I won't have to go on the road anymore. I can spend time with my family. Then you're in a studio for, you know, 14, 15, yeah. 16 hours a day.
Exactly. And you're like Brent Fitz right now, stuck in the corner in the chokey.
Yeah.
Exactly. Making records. Well, thank you so much, Nigel.
Just expand upon that a little bit about the family thing, because wasn't it because of Mike's wife literally coming in and pulling him away from the board that you were tagged to do the last half of the Hysteria mixes?
Yeah, yeah. yeah that
was because it, yeah. she had never seen him in so long, and he was getting so stressed and yeah. and sleep deprived that she actually came and pulled him away from the console.
Yeah. The Jeez same thing Lord. Happened on Pyromania. It wasn't that. It was on Pyromania. It was coming up to Christmas. And Mike had to get back to Australia, which took a couple of days. So yeah. he went, and we had to get this. So I was plunked in, and I did the last five tracks on that.
Wow.
That amazing. Well, you definitely have a career that deserves a part two, if not part three as well. But yeah, we definitely want to thank you for coming on the show today. And, you know, it's been a blast, and we could listen for hours. And, you know, we
walk down memory lane for me. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Want to thank everybody for tuning in today. We've got next week coming up. Who do we got?
I think it's Nick Walsh from Slick Toxic and Moxie. Is that not correct?
Okay. So be sure to tune in next Tuesday. Sure to be a hell of a time.
Ooh. It's like you've done your research.
Waiting for the snare cymbal there.
Yeah, shut up.
Corey, were you going to say something?
I said Badoop Pish.
Oh, there it is. Yes.
Oh, there you go.
Kettle of fish.
Wasn't yeah. loud enough. So, yeah, thanks.
Great, guys. Really
thanks to everybody for tuning in. Yeah, we'll see you next Tuesday. Once again, Nigel, thanks for joining us yeah. and entertaining us with your stories. And we'll be sure to have you on again, and we'll talk, because there's just too much to cover in the short period of time we have. So, thanks, guys, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Bye, everybody. Hey. Thanks, Nigel. Bye. Tube Talk Tuesday. Tube Talk. Tube Talk.